Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. And we're back, and it's Monday morning. And later on, my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. Crows are attacking people in Australia. We're going to talk about that, and then your own personal run-ins with animals, if you've got some crazy stories about animals. And we have a few. And that'll be coming up as well. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We've been off. We took a week off last week, so we've got 2 weeks of movies to talk about. So that's a lot, and we want to get to those, and big holiday releases as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com join me every week. We're back, and so let's get to it, and we're going to talk about the box office as well for this weekend, the 23rd through the 27th of November. So there you go, and let's welcome the guys back to the show. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello there.
Hi, guys. All right. Before we get to the movies, now, Eric, did you watch Gilmore Girls yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Colin, I know you did.
Yep.
I thought it was great.
I'm a happy fan.
Yeah, I am
I know
too.
A lot of fans who aren't happy, but I'm happy.
I don't think it's perfect.
No, never is.
And nope, it's not. I don't think it's perfect, but what I got out of it is exactly what I wanted. Mm-hmm. It made me cry a bunch of times. I was just thrilled to be back in that place with those people. That was, you know, great. The two episodes that Amy Sherman-Palladino directed were the better of the two.
Mm-hmm.
That Daniel Palladino wrote and directed the other two. The only one that, I mean, there were moments where it was like, okay, let's get through this and get to the good stuff.
I mean,
each episode was four episodes. Each episode was 90 minutes. So they were long. The only episode I had major problems with was Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved how much screen time they dedicated to a musical that they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's a common complaint. That's everybody's complaint, and I totally am with that.
I mean, I was like, come on, you know? And not only did they show a bunch of musical numbers, but then they talked about what we had just seen again. Like, they rehashed it. And that was the only, like, I was like, all right. And I mean, there were moments in it that throughout it that, you know, I could be very nitpicky. And I think a lot of the fans are being nitpicky.
Yeah.
But overall, I've received nothing but positive from people. Like, the people that I know who like Gilmore Girls are very, very happy about these four episodes.
Yeah. Most of the controversy is about the ending. And, you know, we're not going to talk about it,
but,
you know, there's so much lore coming up to it, you know, everybody's, you know, Amy Sherman-Palladino has always said she's always known the last four words. So there's always a lot of guessing and speculation about what the last four words are going to be.
Right.
And, you know, once you hear them, you're taken aback, but you know what? Step back a little bit and think about it.
No,
It's perfect. I think it's perfect.
Absolutely perfect. And again, I'm not going to talk about it a lot because I know a lot of people still haven't watched it yet. So I don't want to give anything away or give any details because there are wonderful surprises in it. There really are. And characters that come back, even if they come back for like two lines, mm-hmm. you know, but it's just so cool that they got so many people to come back and they use them perfectly. And I have to say this. They even used Jess well. I thought Jess served a great function. He's, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I wanted to punch Logan in the mouth still, but but there's something that happens in one of the episodes that he's in that is great. So I don't know. I loved it. And Kelly Bishop is a national treasure, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I love her so much. You can
harp on, you know, all the towny stuff taking up way too much screen time, you know, and some of the jokes fall flat, but all the stuff with the main four characters, Rory, Lorelai, Emily, and Luke, all that stuff is solid.
All of it. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. So I loved it, and I watched Fall twice, and just the other three just once, but I'm going to go back and watch them again. So it's great. Eric, it's really great.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to seeing how Stars Hollow fits into Westworld, because that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Oh, is that where you are?
Yeah. I assume that they're all robots by the end of the show.
That's what it is. The final four words are, I am a robot.
That's right.
All right. Okay, let's get to the movies. We got 2 weeks' worth of movies to come out, and then we'll talk about the box office that have come out. Let's start with one that only Colin saw. I didn't have time to see it. I will eventually see it. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. This is Ang Lee's latest movie. And I've been intrigued by the trailer for a few months since I've seen it now.
Okay, well, yeah, Ang Lee, you never know what you're going to get from him. He kind of bounces all over every genre ever. So, you know, anytime I see his name on a poster, I'm always intrigued, no matter what. This one stars Joe Alwyn as Billy Lynn, is a combat soldier who is back from Iraq after seeing some pretty harrowing combat that left his platoon leader, played by Vin Diesel, killed. So he and others in his platoon are home for a victory tour, and, you know, they have to stop at a funeral. And then it's followed by a big televised football game where they have to stand and wave at one point, and then they have to make another appearance during the halftime show where they aren't quite sure what's expected of them. It's this big, lavish musical number. And there's a movie deal in the works, and their manager, who's played by Chris Tucker, is handling the deal with that. And Steve Martin plays a producer who's trying to buy the story right. So, yeah, Steve Martin is turning in a dramatic performance on this one. That's actually pretty good. But the movie itself, it's got a lot of problems. It feels like it has a sense of purpose, but you're never quite sure what the purpose is. You know, I think Ang Lee is trying to make a statement about how he, you know, sort of holds soldiers or people like them up to, you know, celebrity status, in a kind of a weird way that maybe we shouldn't be doing, not out of disrespect, but out of, you know, kind of respect for, I'm not sure. That's what I'm saying is, like, I'm not quite sure where he's going with the material here. The main character, Billy Lynn, is having all the flashbacks, you know, so everything, there's a lot of flashbacks back to Iraq. Especially when they're, you know, doing, you know, being poised for the big musical number, which has a lot of pyrotechnics that, you know, sets off a lot of things. I think a lot of the dialogue is pretty corny, unusually sort of grandiose and what's the word I'm looking for? But, you know, overly kind of patriotic. You know, for an Ang Lee movie, it just seemed kind of like I was watching a film from a different kind of director. And it just kind of, when it was over, I just felt like there's a lot of interesting qualities to this movie. It's Ang Lee, so I want to like it, but I'm just not sure where he's going with this. And I wished, you know, the acting and the script were better. It's been written about a lot that it's filmed in this sort of long, this sort of unique format of like 120 frames per second in 3D. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what the purpose is with that for this movie. You can only see that, I think, in a few theaters across the country. Nowhere in Chicago is that the case, unfortunately. I'd be curious, at least.
Is this the same format that Jackson used on the Hobbit movies?
Jackson's was 48 frames per second.
Oh, okay.
Which was weird enough.
Yeah.
You know, double that. I can't imagine
what
this is like.
Wow.
I really would like to see it. I mean, I would like to know what Ang Lee is going for with that. But when you're watching the movie, you're not, at no point are you sitting there thinking, boy, I wish this was in 3D.
Right, right.
You know, it's just not that kind of movie. But okay, you know, like, again, I want to trust Ang Lee. I want to like Ang Lee. And I'm always rooting for him in his corner and everything. And it's cool that he kind of took that chance and took that risk. But I don't know. Just the movie itself just didn't work for me.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And we've got a lot more movies to talk about with Eric and with Colin. Eric, hang on.
Yep.
All right. And Colin, you hang on as well. And we'll come back with Eric and Colin. More movie reviews. We got to take a break here. We're catching up on last week's reviews since we were off. And then we'll jump into this week's reviews and talk about box office as well. But we'll take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're back. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And welcome back to the show. It's Monday morning. My dad will call in later on. It's jokey time. We're going to talk about animal attacks. But we've got a lot of movies to catch up on. We were off last week, so Eric and Colin are joining me. We're going to talk about last week's movies and this week's movies and the box office on the Monday morning movie reviews that you hear here every Monday morning. Let's get back to it. Here's Eric and here's Colin. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Okay. Hello. Eric, tell us briefly about Christine, and this doesn't involve a 54 Plymouth Fury.
It does not, unfortunately.
Okay.
but this is actually one of two stories, two films, actually, that premiered at Sundance this year about Christine Chubbuck. Now, if that name doesn't ring familiar to you, maybe you might have heard of the story of a local newswoman who committed suicide on air. You probably won't be able to see that footage because it seems it's been pulled just about everywhere. It's just it's not even, like, available, not even at the TV station where she worked. But in this sort of dramatic recreation of what leads up to that event, Rebecca Hall plays the woman, and she's, you know, it takes place in the 70s, so there's sort of a, you know, the pre-feminist movement where, you know, she's trying to get her stories on the air, trying to do some real news, some interesting stories, and just not getting quite the respect that she deserves. On top of that, she's kind of a, you know, a big bundle of nerves. She kind of has that the view that the male viewpoint that women are a little unhinged at the workplace, and so you get a little bit of that sort of that twitchy kind of withdrawn the way that she does this role. And the movie, it seems like it's trying to figure out exactly why she eventually does this and puts her through, you know, not just the medical conditions that she has, but also some new age stuff that was going around at the time, including a trip to a sort of a new age cult brought to her by one of her coworkers, played by Michael C. Hall. Tracy Letts plays the station boss. He seems like he's in, like, every other movie this year.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, kind of a good thing, actually.
Yeah, it is a good thing.
He's been very good in, like, all of these roles. But this one, you know, for all the reasons that I sort of, you know, explained, and having seen the other Christine Chubbuck film at Sundance, this is definitely the lesser of the two. The other one is kind of a pseudo-documentary called Kate Plays Christine, with the actress Caitlin Scheel as herself basically being hired to play Christine Chubbuck and trying to put herself in this character's shoes and try to find out, research, and do as much as she can find out about her and why she might have done this leading up to that very event and whether or not it should actually be shown or explored or recreated. And to see this movie actually do all those things that film kind of argued against, kind of formulated, pre-formulated an opinion on this movie. Rebecca Hall's fine in the role, and I think some of the, you know, the supporting performances are good, but I don't know why, you know, the film had to be done in this manner, and it pales in comparison to the other film.
Okay. All right, that's playing at the Music Box, if you're interested in seeing that one. It's playing at the Music Box only. All right, let's move on. This is still from last week. I did not see this one. You guys did, Colin. Tell us about Bleed for This.
All right, Bleed for This. This is a biopic starring Miles Teller as the boxer who was kind of a middleweight champion, or, you know, junior middleweight champion, Vinny Pazienza, who in the middle of just a regular, he was in a took a car ride with a friend of his and got into an accident that left him paralyzed. He kind of broke his neck, or came severely close to permanently breaking his neck so that he couldn't walk anymore. And he insisted, you know, do any operation you can on me so that I can, you know, walk again, so I can fight again. And his doctors are telling him, you probably won't walk ever again, but we'll do the operation anyway. So he, you know, he's walking around after the operation. He has a halo, like this metal thing fixed to his head so that he can't move. But he's a guy who has no other instinct other than to be a fighter. And that is what he's born and bred for. He's kind of like an animal in that sense. He has no other purpose in life. So, you know, the first chance he gets, he starts lifting weights, but with none of the weights on the weights, just the metal bar, just to lift up and down. His manager is played by Aaron Eckhart, who is sort of secretly training him, you know, in the basement of his, you know, home where he lives with his family. Vinny's dad is part of his entourage. He's, you know, got a girlfriend who, you know, doesn't really, nobody in his family thinks he should be taking, he should be doing any kind of training or weightlifting. So this is a biopic. It's a true story. And, you know, we've already had a biopic boxing film from earlier this year about Roberto Duran called, I think it was, what, Gloves of
Hands,
Hands of Gold?
Hands of Stone.
Hands of Gold.
Hands of Stone. Hands okay. of Stone, yeah.
Right, okay. I'd say this is the better of the two. It's more focused. It's not, you know, it's better edited. The story is clearer. But it's also just also very conventional. You know, it's also coming on the heels of Creed from last year, which was a really beautiful, soulful film with, you know, really wonderful, nuanced performances. And this one is, you know, just kind of falls somewhere in the middle between the two of them. I think Teller, you know, this is the first time Teller's really been, you know, asked to play a part that based on a true character that, you know, has an accent and a certain, you know, look to him and everything. And I think he does a good job. I think he's fine in the movie. Aaron Eckhart is, you know, kind of playing your typical, you know, he's under makeup and playing your sort of typical grouchy, no-nonsense boxing trainer guy. And I think the story is interesting. And I think director Ben Younger does as much as he can to sort of spice up the directing a little bit, trying to make little unconventional choices here and there. But it's not really enough to rise above the material. It's an okay film. It's an interesting story, but it's also incredibly conventional and kind of forgettable.
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, you know, from the end of August through like the Toronto Film Festival, I saw three boxing films, including the one Colin just mentioned, Hands of Stone, this, and a movie called The Bleeder. That was the basically the inspiration for Rocky, essentially. And the best thing I can say about Bleed for this is that it's the best of the three. The worst I can say about it is that it's actually completely forgettable. I mean, conventional is would be kind of a step up, I think. There's nothing about this film that you haven't seen before. Nothing in the performances, nothing in the arc of the character and the story. It's like by the end of, you know, whether he walks again or he's going to fight again, the whole thing just seems very foolhardy and not exactly inspirational. Because we don't really get a real sense of who this guy really was other than, like Colin said, he's just a guy that wants to fight. Well, that's great, but that's not really enough for a movie. I think this really shows. So it's there, it exists, and that's about the best thing I can say about it.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Still working on last week's movies. Eric, tell us about The Edge of 17.
Okay. Well, this is a film stars Hailee Steinfeld as a girl who is going through a very awkward phase of her teenage years. She has never been popular. She's never been really sort of part of the it crowd. She has an older brother played by Blake Jenner from Everybody Wants Some, who is clearly the more popular of the two. He sort of has... you know, heaven has sort of punched his golden ticket in life, if you will. And she certainly pales in comparison. But at a young age, she makes a really good friend, best friend that sort of gets her through, you know, this period. And then things take a turn when the brother and the best friend hook up and begin dating. And this kind of throws her into sort of a tailspin, you know, exactly, you know, who does she have to lean on? She feels there's a betrayal. She feels you know, there's a lot of anger brewing from this character. And her only sort of respite is to bother her English teacher, played wonderfully by Woody Harrelson, who she continues to interrupt on his lunch break at every opportunity to sort of explain her problems. So this is a movie that, you know, we've seen a lot of teenage movies like this before. One thing that really sets this movie apart, though, is the anger thing. And it actually is a movie that is not exactly saying that its lead character not just doesn't have all the answers, but might be actually sort of wrongheaded in her thinking sometimes that, it's not exactly the best thing to just play the martyr card on yourself all the time. You know, maybe there's something that you could, you know, stop blaming everyone else for your lot in life and just, you know, either be or do something about it. And don't direct it at people who aren't, you know, deserving of it. I think Haley Steinfeld is good in the film. I think Woody Harrelson's even better. There's an actor in the movie who plays this shy kid in her class who kind of takes sort of a crush on her,
yeah.
And he is. Hayden Zetto.
Yeah.
He is fantastic.
He's great
in this movie.
Yeah,
steals every scene he's in. I really wish there was more scenes between the two of them. I really liked everything that he does in the movie. As teenage movies goes, this is a cut above the average ones. It doesn't just go for easy jokes. The way, the old John Hughes films does. It's a film that actually has something interesting to say about being a teenager. And, the fact that it was produced by James L. Brooks says that, he had some, interest in this. And it kind of plays like, sort of a teenage version of a James L. Brooks film. Though it was directed by a first-timer named Kelly Freeman Craig. Who I think does a really nice job with the material.
Okay. All right. Hang on. Eric and Colin are with us. We got to take a break, and we'll find out what Colin thought of The Edge of 17 and what I thought of The Edge of 17. We're going to wrap up last week's movies and then continue with this week's new releases as we catch up on the Monday morning movie reviews. And we'll take a break and come back with more after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio. Seventh floor of the Trib Tower, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews, and we're catching up. We were off last week, and Eric Childress just gave us his summation of The Edge of 17. Colin, where do you stand on this one?
I think it's terrific. I think I might even like it more than Eric. I think a month and a half ago, we reviewed a movie called First Girl I Loved, which was a teen drama that really got it right. It was a teen comedy that really gets it right. We've seen Haley Steinfeld in a bunch of movies, obviously, from True Grit. Here, I think she's just demonstrated she's a really funny actress. There are moments in this where she is just, her timing is perfect. The scene where early in the movie where she's completely drunk, she's hilarious in that scene. And I think the stuff between her and Woody Harrelson, I think is some of my favorite scenes, all year. Those are great. Kelly Freeman Craig wrote a movie called Postgrad a few years ago, starring Alexis Bledel, speaking of Gilmore Girls.
Yep.
I thought that movie had moments. It was kind of cute and everything, but I think it would have been a different flavor. I think it would have been a different kind of movie if she had actually directed it. I think it would have been a little less probably cartoonish. She has a really great touch. She's a real actor's director. And it shows when you watch this movie. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I think people should definitely go see it.
I'm with you, Colin. And I know, Eric, you liked it, but I liked it. I think I liked it just as much as you did. I thought it was great, Colin. And I think this is a really great directorial debut, like a really, really strong directorial debut. And, I know that, when you see James L. Brooks' name on something, it's going to have a certain feel to it. And that's absolutely the case here. It feels like James L. Brooks, this is a movie that obviously James L. Brooks' name is put on there for a reason. So, because it feels like that. I think Haley Steinfeld is great. I think she's just terrific. I've always really liked her a lot, but I really think this is the best role she's had, and she runs with it, and she's great, and she's all over the map on this one. She plays angst very well. She's serious in it sometimes. And as you mentioned, Colin, she's hilarious in it. And, the timing that she has between her and Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson is great in this movie. He's so funny and delivers such hilarious lines. The timing between the two of them is great. I think it's a terrific movie, and I think teenagers will love it, and I think adults will love it. I'm 51, and I loved it. So The Edge of 17, it's out right now, and I highly recommend it, and all three of us recommend that one. Okay. Okay, Colin, tell us about Nocturnal Animals.
All right, so this stars Amy Adams as an art museum curator who is handed a copy of her ex-husband's novel, which is his first to be published, or maybe his second. I don't remember. But he's not. He hasn't had much success as a novelist, and this is his newest. And she's a little reluctant to read it, but once she does, we see that it is based on a supposedly true experience, or we infer that it's a true experience that they had with them and their two daughters. So the film is telling two stories. One is Amy Adams reading this book. The other is the book itself. And there we see Jake Gyllenhaal as her husband. And the family is taking a road trip through West Texas late at night. And they get harassed by local thugs who force them to pull over. And things escalate. And Gyllenhaal sees that, you know, his wife and his kids get kidnapped. And then Michael Shannon comes along later, plays a detective who helps him out. But we bounce back and forth between that story and Amy Adams reading the story. And so when you got two different kinds of movies playing, you know, sort of concurrently as you're watching the film. One is this sort of very sort of almost Kieslowski-like character examination with not a lot of dialogue. It's Amy Adams reading a book, looking pensive through most of it. As she, you know, she's kind of has these, you know, reactions to what she's reading, but you're never quite sure what it is that it's she's having the reaction to, except for one point, which I won't talk about. But and then the other is this kind of like Sam Peckinpah film, you know, with the story in West Texas with Michael Shannon and Jake Gyllenhaal. And it's a weird sort of combination that by the end of the film, you're given both stories, but there's nothing that really ties them together that is concrete. And I know that's the way the film is designed. This is a film by Tom Ford, who made a film called A Single Man with Colin Firth a few years ago. And he's very much a visual stylist. And, you know, he likes things to be ambiguous. And I really appreciate his approach to that, to directing and on that level. I think the movie is beautiful to look at. The colors are rich, and, you know, the score, I think, is both films are, you know, sort of have this kind of melodramatic feel to it that's really alive. But by the end, I know I'm supposed to try and put these two stories together, and I just didn't feel interested enough to do that. By the end, I felt like it was kind of empty and kind of cruel in a way. So this is a movie that is really, everybody who is in it is terrific. Obviously it's a great cast, but the directing is, you know, interesting to watch, but the material itself, it just didn't work for me.
Okay. We got a break for the news. Hang on. And when we come back, Eric will give us his review and I will tell you what I thought of Nocturnal Animals. As we catch up on last week's movies, we were off, and we're going to review this week's movies and talk box office as well. But we got a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're back from vacation. Yeah. It's Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a joke later on. We are also going to talk about when animals attack. And much more. All coming up right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Call or text. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to connect with us is to like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. It's interactive. It's constantly being updated while the show is happening. So like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. We are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews playing catch up because we were off last week. So we're reviewing last week's movies for you, and then we'll review this week's new movies and do some box office as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com. RogerEbert.com always join me, and we welcome them back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Colin. Colin just told us about his thoughts on Nocturnal Animals, and Eric, where do you stand on this one?
Well, I mean, I agree with the cruel part. I don't know if I would necessarily say empty, though, although this is a film that at times does have its head firmly up its own backside, I think Tom Ford, that's what Tom Ford does. I was not a particular fan of A Single Man, but I was a bit more intrigued with this one, purposely with putting together the pieces of what the manuscript means and its context to the real life that the Adams and the Gyllenhaal characters had together, and sort of piecing together the sort of the dramatic license that Gyllenhaal, as the novelist, takes with the liberties of his real life story, and I found when the movie was sort of firmly entrenched in what the Peckinpah story, as Colin calls it, I was very much into it. I liked that story. It was suspenseful and interesting, and Michael Shannon kills in it. I think he's really fantastic in this movie. When the movie is sort of dealing with sort of the coldness in Amy Adams' present day life, I was not nearly as interested. But it does lead up to a conclusion that I'm sure will leave a lot of people very cold. I actually found the conclusion actually quite satisfying, and certainly cruel, if you will. And I'm sure that's going to it'll upset a lot of people. I think that if you're upset by the ending, you probably weren't that into any part of the movie to begin with. I'm very curious to watch this, take a look at this a second time. I don't think the movie's great, but I think where the film does work, it does work very well, and that's namely mostly in the performances. And also like to mention Aaron Taylor Johnson, who I have been incredibly critical about over the years, and I don't think he's ever been better than he is in this, as a real scumbag in this film, in book form, at least. So it's kind of a mild recommendation, but I'm recommending it nevertheless.
Yeah, this confirms what I thought about Tom Ford when I saw A Single Man, which is a movie I don't like at all. This guy comes from the world of fashion. He's not a good filmmaker, in my opinion. He could direct the hell out of a perfume ad, which is what a lot of this movie is. In the stuff that you're talking about, the sort of Peckinpah-ish Coen Brothers kind of stuff, besides Michael Shannon, who is incapable of being bad, by the way, even if he's in a lousy movie, he's always like usually the best part of it. That stuff seems forced to me, and like he's way out of his element. I just don't like this guy's style. This guy's style. He gets good actors. And coaxes some good performances out of it. I don't know if it has anything to do with him. Casting is a very big part of that, I think. And when you cast people like Colin Firth or Jake Gyllenhaal, Amy Adams, or Michael Shannon, you're going to get good performances most of the time. I just don't like the way this guy makes movies. I really don't. I don't think there's anything interesting about what he does visually that you can't see in a perfume ad. No. I got to say no. All right, then. Eric, the big one last week, obviously, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, okay. So this is a prequel, I would say of sorts, but it is basically a prequel to the Harry Potter universe, scripted by J.K. Rowling. I don't know how much it has to do, with the book that the film is kind of pseudo-based on, a textbook written by the Eddie Redmayne's character, what's his name, Newt Scalamander, I think it was, Scalamander, something like that. Newt, we'll just call him Newt. Eddie Redmayne plays Newt, who comes to New York in the 1920s with a suitcase full of the Fantastic Beasts of the title. As they sort of unleash themselves in New York City, and he basically has to, with the help of Catherine Waterston, who plays a woman who works for the, your Harry Potter people have to help me exactly who she works for. She works for the police department that basically investigates wizarding and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's close enough, Eric. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And I'm a Harry Potter fan, but I don't know this universe as well as I know Star Wars. So shoot me.
All right.
So they have to hunt down all of these beasts throughout New York City as they, you know, sort of playfully wreak havoc around. But there's also a bad guy on the loose. Dumbledore's nemesis that we only touched upon in the Harry Potter film, sort of talked about in flashback, and he's out there wreaking havoc. There's also another of the wizard police, played by Colin Farrell, who may be a little bit more closer to the events than people really know. And there's all different sorts of characters in the film. Samantha Morton plays a woman who is sort of campaigning against the idea of any kind of wizarding and, you know, spells and things that are out there. And she has a son played by Ezra Miller who has some secrets of his own, very withdrawn in a home life that is very questionable. She's not exactly the moral upstanding citizen that she pretends to be on the outside. There's also a muggle played by Dan Fogler who sort of gets sucked into this adventure unwittingly. He's just a guy that just wants to open up a bakery and happens to witness sort of the unleashing of these fantastic beasts. Okay, so as plots go, that's pretty much what there is, although there is a lot going on in this film. And I actually found myself quite charmed by this film. We're just getting started in this sort of this new expanded universe of Harry Potter. So there's only, there are references and things like that, that again, I'm sure the really hardcore Harry Potter fans will really get into, but I actually really got into these new characters. And it's a string of, actors that I have been critical of in the past, including Eddie Redmayne, who I think is very charming in this film. Dan Fogler, I think, is wonderful in this movie. I've never been a fan of his work in the past. He's always been very over the top and demonstrative. And here he's very kind of sweet. And I really like the romance that the crush that he sort of has on Catherine Waterston's sister in the movie. The actress who's also very good in the movie, that I don't have her name in front of me. But I just kind of went along with this thing. I just found myself just kind of charmed, and I just thought this was kind of just a lovely introduction to this world. And by the end of it, I think the film looks great. It's a period piece, and it's David Yates once again directed this film, and I think he's got just the right touch for this material, as he has shown for the back half of the Harry Potter series. I think I'm really looking forward to seeing where this thing goes, including I really like the fact that there's sort of a kind of a Terry Gilliam-like twist towards the end of this film that I found quite, people who have seen some of the later Terry Gilliam films will understand what I mean by that. But I'm looking forward to seeing where this thing goes.
Okay, hang on, and when we come back, Colin will give you his thoughts on Fantastic Beasts, and I will give you my thoughts as well as we catch up on last week's movies and then move on to this week's movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on WGN. We got a break here. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio, I'm your overnight dude here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive, as it is every day here on WGN. Monday morning, that means my dad will call in and tell a joke a little bit later on, but it also means it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. I'm back from vacation. We were off last Monday, so we did not get together to review the movies, so we are playing catch-up on last week's movies, and we'll start to review this week's movies in a matter of moments here. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, rejoin me, and welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right, we just heard Eric's thoughts on Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. Colin, I know that you're a very big Harry Potter fan.
I'm a fan, and I'm a big fan of the movies, and I like this movie a lot. I think it's really terrific. It takes a little while for me to adjust to a few ideas. Like, we're not going to see, the first 10 or 15 minutes, I had to get we're not going to see Harry, Ron, and Hermione. This is not a preamble to that. We're staying here with these characters. You know, these are grown-ups, and they're going to have their own adventure. And it's in 1920s New York. It's not at Hogwarts. So I got to get used to that. I think the movie is just really, really delightful. And I think one of my favorite things about the film is that we do have a Muggle character, or a nomad, is what they're called now in New York. I like that they have a different phrase for them in New York than they do in London. Nomad, meaning no magic. And we're seeing all of this through the eyes of somebody who's never seen any of this stuff before. And I think that's a really wonderful quality to bring into this film, this, you know, this kind of spinoff film. You know, like the first few Harry Potter movies, you know, you saw like that look in Daniel Radcliffe's eyes when he saw something amazing and unlike anything he's ever seen before, and it's totally transfixing him and transforming him. And you know, you kind of lose that in the last four or five Harry Potter movies. You don't see that anymore, and it's cool to kind of see that again, you know, that this stuff really is fantastic, this stuff really is amazing. And I think Dan Folger is as just the right face for that. His expressions are wonderful. Eddie Redmayne, I love that he's this kind of awkward, socially inept, introvert kind of character instead of the they could have made him charming as hell, but they kind of make him like a guy who just he has a hard time looking at people in the eye. But you still trust him. You still like him. I think. Some of the storytelling gets a little clunky, there's two kind of stories going on at the same time. I think the transition between the two is a little clunky, but on the whole, I think Yates is, again, still the right guy for the job for these movies, and I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I did too. I thought it was really good, and it does take a little bit getting used to the new version of this universe, you know what I mean? The different road that they're going down. But it doesn't, it doesn't take as long as I thought it would, because mm-hmm. I think the direction here in the storytelling is so strong and so confident. And David Yates really is at this point, if they're going to continue making movies in J.K. Rowling's, world of magic and wizards and stuff like that, this guy needs to be the guy to direct all of them. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, he says he wants to. So
yeah. I mean, but he does great. He does great work with this, and really, really wonderful stuff. I liked Eddie Redmayne a lot. I thought the whole cast was really good. You guys already know how I feel about Colin Farrell in everything. I'm a big fan of Catherine Waterston, and I thought there are some surprises in this movie that I wouldn't give away. I thought the special effects were great. It was a little bit darker than I thought it was going to be in spots.
It's, much.
You know, and I didn't expect it to kind of go down that road, and I think the Harry Potter movies started out as PG and then moved on to PG-13. And that's as the audience got older, I think. You know, the books got darker as the series progressed. This is the first in the series, but when I saw it, there were a lot of little kids in the theater, and they were freaking out. Like a lot of the kids were freaking out. So this movie's rated PG-13. Remember that. Don't go, oh, it's a Harry Potter movie. You know, I can bring this is darker than any of the Harry Potter, and some of the Harry Potter movies have gotten very dark, and this continues that tone, and it's even darker. At times. So just be aware of that. But overall, fantastically entertaining, beautifully made. I think it's terrific. And I think it's a great addition to this world. And I'm glad that they're continuing this wizarding world that J.K. Rowling started. And I think it's terrific. And I hope people enjoy it. And we'll talk about the numbers it's making a little bit later on, Eric.
Okay, yes, we will.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, those were the ones from last week, which were a lot. Now we got to get to this week. So let's go to, you're the only one who saw the big winner this week, Eric.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Moana is the new Disney animated movie featuring the voice of The Rock.
Yeah.
I didn't see it, and Colin, I guess, didn't have time to see it either. Okay. So it's all you, Eric.
Okay, well, I'll do my best to explain what this movie is about. Moana is a young girl, I guess, living off Hawaii, Hawaiian island. And, you know, her and her people sing songs, and everything is great and wonderful. But she's constantly told, you know, don't go into the ocean. Don't, you know, there's nothing beyond the ocean. Basically, they're living in the Truman Show. They're just, don't venture out in the ocean. It's dangerous. There's nothing out there. Don't do that. But of course, you know, she's very curious and she wants to know what else is out there besides the little universe that her family and tribe have carved out for themselves. And as the paradise that they've created begins to show some cracks, coconuts are gone bad and food starts to become in short supply. She believes she has to set out on an adventure to help her people out. So this leads her into getting out there under the ocean and looking for evidence of the classical story of Maui, the adventurers played by Dwayne Johnson, who, as legend has it, stole this like ancient stone from the gods or an island or something, and it put everything into turmoil. And they have to seek out Maui and find the stone to reclaim everything and put everything back together and restore the balance of the universe. That's pretty much what I got out of the plot. Because the first half hour of the film, the songs in the movie are done by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who everyone knows is, the creator of Hamilton.
Really?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No, Nick? What's that?
You've never heard of Hamilton?
No.
Oh, let me tell you about what the vice president did. never mind. But anyway, so the first half hour of this movie is really heavily populated with these songs. And the songs are actually really catchy and really wonderful. And, I was just really sort of, I couldn't wait to leave the theater and download some of the songs and listen to the soundtrack. And I was, like, wow, this is really sort of nice stuff. And then, which probably shouldn't have been a huge surprise, much the way that I felt with Frozen, which I also thought began with some really wonderful songs, then the story begins to take precedent. And as the story takes precedent, the songs kind of go by the wayside. And the more that the story sort of developed itself and it just became sort of a routine adventure story, I began to lose interest very quickly. I became quite bored with the material. I kept wanting to return to some of those wonderful songs. I was not a fan of the Maui character played by Dwayne Johnson, other than his introduction. He has a good song introduction. I like the fact that there are sort of coconut pirates out there, and this film could have used more coconut pirates. But once they have been introduced and thrown aside and we're dealing with giant, large, bejeweled crabs and the volcano ashes that want the sacred stone back, I had long stopped caring about anything that was going on in this movie. I kept wanting to return to the songs. As beautifully animated as the film is at times, I just found myself quite bored with where this film eventually went. So I know there are a lot of people that are recommending this movie, but I can't.
$81 million it made.
Yeah, good. I hope people enjoyed it. I was falling asleep.
Okay. All right. That's the new Disney film, Moana. And Eric says no, and Colin and I did not get a chance to see it. All right, guys, hang on. We got to take another break here, okay?
Okay.
All right, hang on. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, I'm the only one that saw Bad Santa 2. So we'll take care of Bad Santa 2. And then we've got Manchester by the Sea and Allied to talk about as well as we finish up the new movie reviews and then get into the box office as well here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We got a ton of movies that we had to catch up on from last week. We're reviewing the new movies from this week. We got box office. And that's all coming up right here on WGN. Eric Childress, Colin Suter joining me. It's Monday morning. That means later on my dad will call and tell a jokey time. And We're going to talk about animals attacking and your personal stories of crazy animal stories. But right now we're in the middle of reviewing all the new movies, and we're up to this week's releases. Eric Childress is here and Colin Suter. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. So neither of you saw Bad Santa 2?
No.
Okay. The only reason am I the only one that hates that, the first one?
We all do.
I hate it, too.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, so I'm not, I mean, but I'm in a minority. We're in the minority on that, by the way, as you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people love that movie. I hated it, and I thought it was mean-spirited and not particularly funny. I thought maybe the first 10 minutes were kind of funny, and then it just completely dissolved into just a really mean-spirited, not very funny film. So I was not looking forward to this one, but my dad wanted to see it really badly. So that's the movie. This is the movie I went to with my parents this weekend. Was Bad Santa 2. And you know how inappropriate the first one got. This one is even more inappropriate. But I got to say, it's better than the first one. The tone is not as mean-spirited at all. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the kid is now 21. And, you know, he's still, you know, a doofus. But it doesn't seem as harsh. The stuff that Billy Bob Thornton, the exchanges between the two of them, doesn't seem nearly as harsh as what it was in the original movie. Anyway, the sequel is this. Billy Bob Thornton gets pulled out of whatever he's doing, which is basically drinking, and he's about to kill himself at the beginning of the movie. He's trying to hang himself at the beginning of the movie when an envelope arrives with a cell phone, a note, and a bunch of cash. And it comes from his, but I'm forgetting the guy's name. Tony Cox played him, Marcus, the dwarf. He wants him to come back and pull another robbery, despite the fact that Marcus tried to kill him in the first film. And so the idea is that they're going to travel to Chicago, where most of this movie takes place, right here in Chicago, and they're going to rob a charity. He has to get back into the Santa suit and be a volunteer for this charity. And they're going to work their way into the building by being employees or volunteers. There's a safe inside where the guy who runs the charity is corrupt, and he takes a bunch of cash, hides it in there, and they've got inside information about it thanks to Kathy Bates, who is in this movie, who plays Billy Bob Thornton's mom in the film. Christina Hendricks shows up, thank God, because you can look at her. And the idea is that he's going to crack the safe. They're going to steal the money while there's a Christmas concert going on down on the first floor of this charity in an auditorium where a bunch of kids are singing Christmas carols. And the kid from the first movie shows up, the Thurman Merman kid. He shows up. He's 21. He still tries to be friends with Billy Bob Thornton. And then the movie starts out in Phoenix, and then they end up traveling to Chicago to do the heist. And then Thurman Merman takes a bus to Chicago with no coat and just gets off the bus and says, hey, where's my friend Willie? And starts looking for him. They find each other, and he becomes part of the story as well. And they're all trying to do this heist. And Billy Bob Thornton hasn't seen Kathy Bates. They've been estranged. He hates her. They have a very contentious relationship, and so on and so forth. All right. It's not very good, but it's much better than the first movie. There are a lot more laughs in this one than there were in the first one. And there's outrageous and incredibly vulgar stuff in this movie. And you shouldn't be surprised by that. I got to say, I loved watching Billy Bob Thornton and Kathy Bates together. And they acknowledged the fact that Kathy Bates is only like 12 years older than Billy Bob Thornton. So they acknowledged that in the movie. I just love watching them together. And I don't know. I was excited to see them together because I loved them so much in Primary Colors. And I just, it was like, oh, they're back together after 18 years or whatever with Primary Colors. And so I just like that. And they're very funny together. And they've got outrageous stuff to say and do. And they seem to be having a blast doing it. I got to say, Billy Bob Thornton is perfect for this role. You know, Christina Hendricks doesn't really do anything. She's got a kind of a dumb character, but she's got a dark side and was once an alcoholic. And that is brought out in her behavior by Billy Bob Thornton. They do some nasty things. Clearly, heavily R-rated stuff here. As vulgar a movie as you'll likely to see with in terms of behavior and language and sexual situations. But there are. I'm not recommending it, okay? But it's much better than the first one, in my opinion. There are a lot more laughs. There were a couple of moments in this movie when I did laugh very, very hard. It's short. It's dumb. I'm not sure how the people who like the original are going to feel about it. I would imagine they won't like it because it's different. Mark Waters directed this movie, who directed Mean Girls, doesn't really put a huge stamp on it, just kind of puts the camera in front of their faces and lets them drop F-bombs and talk really disgusting, and then that's about it. As a heist movie, it's stupid, so I'm not really recommending it, but I was surprised that I enjoyed as much of it as I did. So there you go. All right. Okay. So, Colin, why don't you tell us about Manchester by the Sea?
All right, so this is another comedy. And it stars, not really, folks. No, this is a heavy one. It stars Casey Affleck as a local janitor in a Massachusetts town who has lost his wife, played by Michelle Williams, and who, you know, kind of keeps to himself. But his brother, played by Kyle Chandler, dies of a sudden heart attack, and Affleck is forced to look after his teenage nephew, played by Lucas Hedges. But Affleck, he's kind of battling demons on a daily basis, doesn't really have the temperament or the know-how to deal with, you know, being a father figure to an angry teenager. So they constantly butt heads, especially when Affleck is trying to figure out a way to get this kid off to a new life, but at the same time doesn't want to make him feel like rejected by everyone he knows. So this is a movie that is a character study of Affleck's character, who is just kind of this sort of tormented loner, you know, lives in a basement apartment, you know, one room apartment, puts himself into random fist fights at local taverns. And now he's got to deal with this kid. And I think the movie is definitely a showcase for some of the best performances of the year, particularly by Affleck, who is just tremendous in this film. But it's also, you know, it's kind of a hard movie to watch sometimes, because he is certainly not the easiest character to warm up to. And, you know, when you're dealing with an angry teenager who dealing with a lot of grief, he makes him very unsympathetic, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, he says to him. But this is a really a fascinating film from a fascinating director who's only his third film. He did You Can Count on Me, and then many years later did Margaret with Anna Paquin, which was a long hiatus, you know, between films. And this is a guy who really takes his time, but he's also a director who is very much in tune with each and every one of his characters and their backstories and their emotions and everything. And you can tell that these are actors who really love working with this director. They're doing some of their best work ever. Again, this is a heavy film, very a sad, almost, you know, kind of somber film, but a really beautiful one. So with some of the best performances you're going to see all year.
Okay, Eric.
Yeah, I think this is Lonergan's best work to date. This is a movie that premiered at Sundance this year, and I got to like the second screening of it, and by then it had already sort of reached that legendary Sundance status. That is the film that everyone was talking about. Everyone said it was going to be one of the best films of the year, and they're pretty on target with this one. It's a film that actually lived up to the hype. Colin kind of wisely kind of tap danced around certain aspects of the film that obviously we don't want to give away and spoil here, but the more you sort of peel away the layers of the sort of the backstory and the things that are going on in this character's life, it's, you know, it's kind of impossible in some way, you know, to not to empathize with him. And Affleck, you know, it's, you know, the performance, you know, this is a guy that's given some really terrific performances. You know, you talk about, you know, Robert Ford in the Jesse James film, or, you know, even Gone Baby Gone. He's done some really fantastic work in the past, and this is clearly his crowning achievement. There's a scene very late in the film between him and Michelle Williams that's maybe the best dramatic scene between two actors you're going to see all year. It's an unbelievably heartbreaking scene. And, you know, by the time this movie, you know, this is not a movie with easy answers. This is not a movie where, everything is going to be tied up in a very little bow, pretty little bow. And by the end of it, when you sort of get to a point where, you know, the characters have sort of made their decision and sort of have to accept their lot in life, I think, you know, we've all sort of been there, and, you know, uncomfortably so, that we have to admit sometimes, you know, that, you know, not everything is going to work out in our favor. This is a heavy film, and, you know, but in a great way, in the way great dramas are. And everyone in this film contributes to it, but it's also very funny too. There are really funny scenes between Affleck and Lucas Hedges. Lonergan actually has a really funny cameo at one point in the film. This is absolutely one of the strongest works of the year.
Okay, we got a break here, guys, and I'll give you my thoughts on it as well. It's going to be very similar to what you guys just said. So hang on a second, Eric and Colin are here. We're talking about a great film called Manchester by the Sea. And I'll give you my review of it. And we've got Robert Zemeckis' latest Allied to talk about. Plus, we'll touch on the box office as well. But right now, we got a break for weather and traffic. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Coming up after the news, we're going to talk about the stories about these crows that are attacking people in Australia. So we're going to talk about when animals attack. But right now, we got to finish up the movie reviews and briefly touch on box office. Eric Childress is here. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin Suter. And they both just gave their review of Manchester by the Sea. And I echo everything you guys said. This is easily one of the best movies of the year. I think it's Lonergan's best work as well. And it's, I personally think it's Casey Affleck's Oscar to lose. I'm telling you. I mean, first of all, there's no question he's going to be nominated.
Most likely, yes.
Oh, man. Come on. I don't want to hear hesitation.
Well, you know, there shouldn't be hesitation as far as the performance is concerned.
Yeah,
but there were some stories about his past.
Oh man,
that have come
out.
So, just saying.
All right. Anyway, I was gutted by this movie, absolutely gutted, and it was interesting because when the film ended, we all just everybody sat there and like didn't move for a little while. You know what I mean? It was one of those deals where it was like, whoa. And it does have great funny moments, and I don't want to make everybody think it's nothing but depression. But it's a very heavy film, and it truly gutted me. And I think Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams, everybody in this movie, is great. The performances are uniformly amazing. But this is like as you said, Eric, this is like a career defining performance for Casey Affleck. Mm-hmm. You know, who's always been good in movies, and still, you know, his performance in Jesse James is still one of my favorite performances and one of the most deeply disturbing performances I've ever seen, and hypnotic, and he's amazing in this. It's a completely different kind of character, and it's the kind of character that Lonergan excels at making movies about. You know, if you think about Ruffalo's character and You Can Count on Me and some of the plays that Lonergan has written, he likes to talk about these sort of damaged people who are emotionally screwed up and who have to change their ways and be better people. And that's something that shows up in Lonergan's work over and over and over and over again. It's obviously a theme that he's fascinated by. This is the best of the movies, the three movies that he's made. And Casey Affleck, as I've said, is amazing in it. And you're right, Eric, the scene between him towards the end with Michelle Williams is a killer. It's a killer. It's playing at three theaters. It's playing at the River East down here, and it's playing at the Landmark Century on Clark, and it's playing at the Century 12 in Evanston. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. It is absolutely one of the best movies of the year, and it's Manchester by the Sea. You will not be disappointed if you see this film at all, and in fact, you'll probably be a little bit devastated. It's an astounding piece of work. So there you go. All right. Let's see. Let's talk. Colin, what about Allied?
All right. This is Robert Zemeckis' latest, and stars Brad Pitt as an American spy during World War II. At the beginning of the film, he's in North Africa on a mission. He meets a French resistance fighter played by Marion Cotillard, and the two have to pose as a couple behind enemy lines. She coaches him in French. He does his best to call the shots for the plan, but, you know, she's pretty good with a machine gun. So they go through it with the plan, and I won't say what happens, but they meet up later in London, and their relationship they were faking kind of comes to fruition in real life, and they have to start a new life together. And then things get a little complicated. So this is, like I said, Robert Zemeckis' film. I think it's a film that feels the least like a Robert Zemeckis film, other than the opening shot, you know, which is, you know, one of Zemeckis' little trick shots. But after that, it feels like an old-fashioned spy thriller. Brad Pitt is very good in the film. Marion Cotillard is especially good in the film. And I think it's a film that Zemeckis had a real, feels like he had a real investment in these characters and wasn't really relying so much on, you know, visual trickery or anything to tell this story. It was, it kind of belongs in the same category with Flight from a few years ago. And that it, when you're watching it, you're not giving the story that's a little too fantastical to be real. This is really a refined piece of work from Robert Zemeckis. It's not in my top 10 of his films, but I think it's a really, really solid old-fashioned World War II spy thriller.
Okay.
It was World War II, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
All right. Okay, Eric?
Yeah, no, I liked it too. Again, it would not be in my top 10 Zemeckis either, but I there was something really kind of refreshing about seeing him do sort of a classical spy thriller. And, you know, at times, you know, sort of upon reflection of this, it seemed kind of like his own Zemeckis-y cynical view of Casablanca. This is sort of his, you know, his sort of World War II love story with spies and intrigue and, you know, double crosses and all those kinds of things. It has that feel to it. You know, I think Marion Cotillard is terrific in the film. Brad Pitt is very restrained in this movie, but Cotillard is really good. And it just, you know, the first time I saw it, I was expecting there was going to be more twists and turns. I thought like Colin said, it doesn't feel very much like a Zemeckis film, with the exception of, you know, a couple shots, you know, particularly in the first lovemaking scene and Silvestri's score, which is very prominent in the film. But like Flight and the Walk, which I think were films that were kind of about, you know, this, you know, filmmaking and, you know, careers and things like that. This one just sort of feels like kind of like he wanted to do something very old fashioned, and that's what he did. As World War II Brad Pitt films go, I was kind of hoping that Cotillard, when he's coaching him in different languages, was going to teach him
Italian.
Buongiorno.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but no, it's a good film, and I think, you know, upon subsequent viewings, it's probably going to reach a higher plateau, as most of Zemeckis films usually do for me.
Yeah, I loved it, and I did. I love everything. I pretty much love almost everything that Robert Zemeckis does. This is a departure for him in many ways, but it's still visually sumptuous and beautiful, and there are wonderful uses of special effects. They don't call themselves out, but they're wonderful uses of special effects. And once again, this is, you mentioned cynical, Eric. His movies are very subversive, and this is it is a total subversive take on those old-time World War II romance and spy movies. And it's got that undercurrent, that great Zemeckis undercurrent all the way through it. This would not be in my top 10 Zemeckis movies, but I think it's a terrific piece of work from, I personally think, the best American commercial filmmaker alive today. And he continues, for me, to just year after year, when he makes movies, makes really beautiful, great movies that are takes on what he loves about cinema, and he does them in a way that no other American filmmaker does. And I love him, and I thought this movie was terrific, and I highly recommend it.
I will say really quick that I actually unexpectedly found myself incredibly moved by the final moments of the movie.
Me too. Me too. Okay, very quickly, next week we've got Jackie. We've got The Eyes of My Mother and other stuff. I wanted to quickly, Eric, before we let you go, $81 million broke some records, right, for Moana?
Yeah, second best 5-day Thanksgiving weekend ever, behind just Frozen and ahead of Toy Story 2. Of course, that was in 1999, so
yeah,
those dollars are a little less inflated.
Yeah.
But still, a very, very solid opening for it.
Yeah, that was the big story this week for box office. All right, we had so much stuff to talk about. That's why we couldn't talk about box office in at length. But people can go to movies.com to read your piece. Eric,
yeah.
Colin, thank you guys, and we will talk
all
to
right.
you both next week, okay?
Sounds good.
All right.
Good.
All right. We got a break here for the news, and that's coming up next here on WGN.
What day is it?